So my name is Gyukshin. I'm the director of the Walter Schoenstein Asia Pacific Research Center here at Stanford. And our center and the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies are very honored to host Ban Ki-moon, the 8th Secretary General of the United Nations. The Secretary General and I have known each other for more than a decade. And we are very happy and lucky to host you again. This is your second trip to Stanford in 3 years. And I'm very grateful that in year 2013, you kicked off a series of events commemorating our center's 30th anniversary. So thank you for coming again to our center. Thank you. So few people are better qualified to speak about the UN, which is 70 years ago to this day, came into fruition. In 1945, delegates from across the world signed a charter in San Francisco, therein establishing one of the foremost international organizations. The ties that bind the Bay Area with the UN are pronounced, and the audience here today, and all of you, is reflective of the strength of a globally minded population in the Bay Area. I extend special thanks to the Asia Society, the Asia Foundation, and the World Affairs Council of Northern California, who served as a co-sponsors for this event. Okay, now I'd like to introduce Ambassador Kathy Stevens, who will introduce Secretary General Ban and moderate a conversation following his remarks. And then we will launch into a question and answer session. As you may know, Kathy held a long distinguished career in public service. From 2008 to 2011, she was the U.S. ambassador to Republic of Korea and often cited as one of the most popular envoys ever into South Korea. So she recently returned from leading the U.S. mission in India for the first 7 months of the new Modi administration. Kathy first came to our center as a Kuret Fellow in 2013, and I'm very happy to say that she will return this fall as a William Perry Distinguished Fellow in the Korea program. So please join me in welcoming Kathy to the podium. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much, Professor Shin. It is such a great honor to join you and join all of you in welcoming back to Stanford United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. I am absolutely delighted to introduce someone I have so long admired. As Professor Shin already noted, Secretary Ban is the 8th Secretary General of the United Nations, assuming office in 2007. In 2011, he was unanimously reelected by the UN General Assembly for a second term. Now, you've probably heard the UN Secretary General's job called the world's chief diplomat. I've also heard it called the world's hardest job. So maybe they got the right man for it. As Secretary General Ban outlined in an op-ed I read this morning commemorating the 70th anniversary of the UN, during his tenure, he has continued to focus on mobilizing the leaders of the world, the people of the world, around critical global challenges, sustainable development, climate change, human rights. And in that context, I think it's particularly notable that earlier today, I think just before he came down here in San Francisco, the Secretary General's leadership of Free and Equal, the campaign Free and Equal, was recognized with the Harvey Milk Medal. How timely that recognition is, and how it reminds us that Secretary General Ban has approached the toughest challenges with formidable energy, a luminous humanity, and absolute commitment. If you want to get a sense of how much this man does, you can do what I did in getting ready to introduce him. Look on his schedule of travel and meetings on the UN website, or even his schedule in the Bay Area today. But this operational tempo and these qualities have long defined Ban Ki-moon. And I think it's fitting that the UN Secretary General in this 70th anniversary year of the founding of the United Nations is a man whose home country is Korea, a life story that has been deeply entwined with the United Nations' 70 years of history. In his first decade of life, as a child, in the hills of Chungcheongbuk-do, in the hills in the heart of Korea, Ban Ki-moon experienced liberation from Japanese occupation, followed by national division, a terrible war, and an uneasy truce. And in the midst of such tragedy, national tragedy, human tragedy, and hardship, young Ki-moon's brilliance shone in the local high school, Chungju Gorunghakyo, I believe. It propelled him to what at that time was very unusual, a visit as a teenager to San Francisco. And it propelled him to Korea's top university, from which he joined the Korean diplomatic corps. And I really think that his legendary diplomatic career, and indeed it is, was a kind of present at the creation sort of career, shaping rising South Korea's growing engagement with the world. Like Professor Shin, I recall meeting then Foreign Minister Ban about 10 years ago. And actually, it was at the UN General Assembly in New York. I read in the San Francisco Chronicle today that should have been in San Francisco. But anyway, it was in New York. And I was accompanying Secretary of State Condi Rice, who also shares an affiliation with Stanford, in meeting with Foreign Minister Ban. And there I saw, in action, a real diplomat, a real negotiator, as Foreign Minister Ban worked with Secretary Rice and the other foreign ministers to forge agreement on what became the joint statement of principles in the six-party talks. Now, while a lot of things in life and diplomacy, those principles are not fully implemented, then Foreign Minister Ban, now Secretary General Ban, has been unwavering in his commitment to a brighter future for the Korean Peninsula, one of real peace and reconciliation and a better life for all the people of the Korean Peninsula. So Secretary General Ban's extraordinary life and career, infused with the humility and fierce dedication that are his hallmarks, have inspired me, have inspired us all. And I think that's why we see such an enthusiastic and overflow crowd here today. Secretary General Ban, we look forward to your reflections today as we mark the 70th anniversary of the United Nations Charter, and to your insights on the United Nations at 70 and going forward. Welcome, Secretary General.
Thank you, Ambassador Shimon Gyeong. That's her Korean name, Ambassador Catherine Stevens, and Professor Kyuk Shin, and distinguished faculty members. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to stand before you for a second time as Secretary General of the United Nations. I thank Stanford University and Walter H. Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center for hosting this conversation. Thank you for your very kind introduction. It's a great pleasure to be introduced by somebody whom I have known and admired and who has also shown great diplomatic skill as a U.S. ambassador to Korea during such a very difficult time. And she has been, I think there have been many U.S. ambassadors in Korea, but she is definitely the most loved and respected. She has even acquired the Korean name, Shimon Gyeong. Thank you very much for your contribution. And there are many people whom I may have to recognize, but Before I begin, I'd like to recognize Ambassador Kim Suk, who is now here as a fellow, with whom I have been working very, very closely in Korean government. And thank you. I hope you have become much knowledged and will use your such knowledge and academic experience when you go back to Korea. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to also recognize Consul General Han, who is a Consul General in San Francisco, Han Dongman, who has come to participate in this lecture series. And I thank you very much, Consul General. I'm visiting San Francisco today to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter. It was today, 70 years ago, in San Francisco, that the delegations from 51 countries, they signed such a historic United Nations Charter, which is still guiding this world in terms of human rights, development, and peace and security. While there might have been some weakness or failures or shortages in United Nations capacity delivering what has been expected, but I think United Nations has been really keeping this world much more peaceful and trying to lift billions of people out of abject poverty and trying to help promote and protect the human rights and human dignity of billions of people. Otherwise, whose human rights and human dignity might have been abused. Still, there are many people whose human rights are being abused, who are still suffering from poverty. That's what United Nations is doing, and that's what I am very much honored to serve as a Secretary General of this indispensable organization. Now, talking about your college, your university, you are the birthplace of household names. Hewlett-Packard, Google, Netflix, Instagram, PayPal, Snapchat, and many more. Many of my senior advisors working in the United Nations alumni, graduates of this Stanford. Stanford name itself carries far and wide around the world. Therefore, you should be very proud that you are part of this Stanford University. And I'm also very much honored to stand here for a second time as a Secretary General. I'm grateful to this institution for its contributions to the world. I will always appreciate the chance to visit California. This is the first place I visited outside of Korea when I was just simply 18 years old, a high school boy. I have never traveled outside of Korea. I was lucky enough to have been chosen as one of the four Korean students by the American Red Cross Society. There was a meeting in Washington, D.C. I remember that there were about 140 students around the world who came to the United States. They traveled around the United States. My first city I arrived was San Francisco. And there I stayed 8 days in Bay Area, Novato, California. I have, in fact, two mothers. One is in Korea. She is 95 years old. I have another American mother, 97 years old, Mrs. Patterson. She's here with us. And her beautiful family, my brothers and sisters and in-laws, and they are all here. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you. This is the place where I was lit by what I saw. American culture and the way you are leading the world. That's the place. This is the place where I was able to open up my eyes for as a global citizen. As you may know, my story, this is well known. I was able to visit several cities. Then after that, I ended up in Washington, D.C., and stayed there 1 week. And I was lucky enough to be one of 140 students to visit President John F. Kennedy at that time in the Rose Garden. Just imagine that such a country boy from South Korea, Chungju, unknown, dusty, and poor, devastated by Korean War. It was just 9 years after armistice agreement was signed. So you can imagine how poor Korea was. From there, from almost hell to heaven, I came to San Francisco and the United States and Washington. At that time, President Kennedy, I cannot remember all what he said, but if I may just say, he said that it was in the height of Cold War. Well, the leaders of the world, there are some leaders of the world who are not getting along well with each other. But I think you student, young people, you can do it. And there are no national boundaries these days already. Even at that time, 1962, he said, there are no national boundaries. Only question is that how much you are ready to extend your helping hand to other people. So it was quite the inspiring moment for me. That was the moment which really I decided that I should do something bigger than what Korea could do. That was the moment which really gave me a vision as a global citizen. Then I really wanted to do something beyond transcending the boundaries of the national governments. That's what I'm doing as Secretary General. There are still many people who need our helping hands. 60 million refugees are there as of now. And there are still billion people who go to bed every night with their hungry stomach. There are many refugees, many displaced people. I was one of the displaced persons. When Korean War broke out, I had to flee my hometown. My hometown, my schools were all bombarded and destroyed. When I went back after the war, there was no classrooms. We had to study on the ground without classrooms. At that time, 16 countries sent their young soldiers, young men, and at that time there were not many women. Then 5 more countries, they sent their medical teams, so 21 countries. Then at that time, I do not know exactly how many, maybe there must have been 60, not more than 60 countries of membership, 21. One third of member states, they have sent all these soldiers and medical teams. It was a hugely generous and human support. Because of that, I was able to now serve my country, and now I'm serving the international community, the world. At that time, there's a blue flag of United Nations, blue flag. That was the beacon of hope to us. Whenever I saw UN troops carrying United Nations flag, that was our lifeline. And they sent the textbooks, they sent all food and very humanitarian assistance, which I am now doing, sending water, medicines, and all this sack of grains. I'm sorry to say that we still have to continue to do that. What United Nations did in 1950, but we are still doing even more. More wars and more refugees. That really makes me humbled as a Secretary General. At the same time, that really motivates me every day and night. Whenever I wake up, get up in the morning, then I'm thinking what and how I should do better than they did for us in 1950. We are really doing our best efforts. Ladies and gentlemen, this 70th anniversary of the United Nations is a good moment. Of course, we celebrate. But this moment of celebration should give us to look beyond. Rather than looking back, we have to look for the future. That's why I am here. This is a very crucial year. Year 2015 is a year for global action. The politicians, they have all some bad or good habit. They always say that this is the most important year for me, or something like this, governor, president. Why? Because this is my first year. Then let us work together. Then I, as a Secretary General, maybe I may also emphasize that this is the most important year for humanity, 2015. Why? Then 2015 is the most important year. Every year might have been important, but by any standard, by any criteria, I can tell you that this is the most important for humanity. I'll tell you why. This year, we are approaching deadline of Millennium Development Goals. This is the blueprint. The leaders at the dawn of new millennium, 2000, they presented their vision, saying that we will cut in half the people living in poverty. I think we did. We did. But because of continuing economic crisis, another 100 million people have been driven into poverty line. Then we really wanted to have gender equality. That we are a little bit far away from this gender equality. And there are many unnecessary deaths, particularly women and girls, and women particularly complicated with the pregnancy and childbirth, unnecessary mortality, maternal mortality, child mortality. Millions of children are dying from preventable diseases, malaria, tuberculosis, all this. These are all preventable diseases, but you see every day several thousand people, young children, they are dying. That is why we have to shape a better and more far-reaching, more visionary development agenda. That's what we are now doing. In September this year, President Obama and all other leaders, including Pope Francis, will come at my invitation. I expect that they will adopt a far-reaching, ambitious, much more ambitious development agenda with a set of sustainable development goals. This should be a sustainable in social, economic, and environmental area. This Millennium Development Goals, what we have been saying, MDG, has been mostly on poverty eradication and preventing human lives. But this should be far-reaching, including caring about our planet Earth, where we are now living. So this is a people-centered and planet-friendly. So we are covering all spectrums of our life, socio-economic and environmental, planet Earth. You just, when they adopt 17 goals in the United Nations, tell me which is not covered. Second, by December this year, we have to adopt a climate change, universal and very ambitious and applicable to all the countries of the world. We must have this one. The member states have been discussing during the last 20 years without taking any action, even abusing their privileges of living harmoniously with nature. You cannot fight against nature. You cannot negotiate with nature. Nature just goes in its own way. Then quite evident. As a human being who has to have wisdom to live harmoniously what nature tells us. So we have been abusing our nature. The people seem to believe that we have two planet Earth. No, we have only one. We have only one Earth. There is no second Earth where you can move when we will have abused this planet Earth. That's why I have made this climate change as a top global agenda. I think we are moving toward the right direction. You should know that when you live in the United States, you simply do not understand what is happening beyond the boundary of the United States. How many people are suffering from poverty, drought, inundation of floodings, and also these diseases. That's why we are working very hard. This year, if we do not take action this year, we will have to regret many years to come. Regret for our succeeding generations. Our children, great-children, great-great-grandchildren, we will be abusing and abandoning your moral responsibility as a human being. That is why I'm really asking world leaders to be more focused and more committed to make this happen this year. That's why I emphasized it today, celebrating 70th anniversary of the United Nations. Now then, ladies and gentlemen, is it only this development? I think we are still suffering from these wars. The international community has been committing and pledging that never again, never again. Of course, we have been able to prevent any third world war. There has been no such a third world war. Thus, we may say that we have been able to keep our promise, which has been stated in the Charter of the United Nations, to save succeeding generations from scourge of war. That we have done, but there is no guarantee. But there have been genocide. In 1994 in Rwanda, 1995, just 20 years ago, in Srebrenica, there were hundreds of thousands of people were killed. That we committed that there should be never again. But this never again commitment has been broken, unfortunately. We are in the fifth year of a devastating conflict in Syria. That continues to worsen. Humanitarian suffering in Yemen is affecting millions of people. Just 10 days ago, I was in Geneva. I brought two warring parties to Geneva. We have not been able to have a good solution yet. We are still working. South Sudan, the world's youngest country, is suffering from 18 months of civil war. More than 4.5 million people are severely food insecure. These and other conflicts along the poverty has driven 60 million people internally displaced and refugees. That's a serious issue. United Nations is working hard to address these challenges. Globally, United Nations is keeping 120,000 soldiers abroad in 16 hot spots. Jokingly, I'm saying that I'm most powerful leader in the world, only next to President Obama. Why? There are no country except United States who maintains more than 120,000 soldiers abroad. Even UK, France, or no country. They normally keep less than 10,000 soldiers. But I'm the commander-in-chief of 120,000 soldiers. This I'm just jokingly saying. Of course, you know, I do not have that power like President Obama. We are really trying to save human lives from abhorrent crimes, human rights abuses and violations. Many now had to be deployed in the places where there is a little peace or no peace at all to keep. But still, United Nations has to be there. As you may remember, when Korean War broke out, there were almost 300,000 soldiers coming from all around the world, with millions of casualties. That was the first time for the United Nations to enforce peace, to make peace. But these days, we do not have that kind of enforcing soldiers. We are keeping peace. When there are fighting, warring parties, we just go in the middle and try to keep them at bay. Just to try to keep. But these days, unfortunately, we have to send our young men and women where there is no peace to keep. That's why we have a lot of casualties now. Recently, I have received a report from a high-level panel, which I established, how we can improve the United Nations peacekeeping operations that I'm now still studying and will report to the General Assembly. Now, there is another very troubling, very worrisome situation is happening. This is violent extremism and terrorism. This is spreading like cancer around the world. Young men and women, particularly, who do not know much about all these values of human being, are just trapped into narrative, hate narrative, and ideological narratives, and joining ISIS or Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda. This is quite worrisome. That is why United Nations takes very seriously that I'm going to present the comprehensive plan of action, how we can address this extremism. You may be surprised that tens of thousands of European citizens are joining this ISIS and Boko Harams. Why are they joining this one? International community has let this kind of a cancerous extremism spread. I think this is a failure of leadership, injustice, inequality, and driving all these young people to the corner where they could not find any way out. When they see just the complete despair about their future, then they become easily prey of these extremist narratives. That we have to prevent. That's one of the top priority of the United Nations in addition to all development issues. When counterterrorism efforts ignore the rule of law and violate fundamental rights, they not only betray the values they seek to uphold, but can also end up further fueling violent extremism. So that's why I'm urging world leaders, particularly where we cannot see got rule of law and right-based rule of law. And when we see prevalent cases of inequality and injustices. Ladies and gentlemen, let me now, because of time limit, let me offer a few reflections of Asia and Pacific. Since this California and Stanford University has been one of the center of academics where you've been training and educating the future leaders of Asia Pacific. This is the gate to Asia Pacific. The engines of growth and economic power continue to shift with the rise of Asia Pacific region as a center of dynamism and influence. I welcome the growing global prominence and engagement of China and India, key member states and close partners of the United Nations on many of the organization's priority areas. There is also a key for efforts to establish the ASEAN community among Southeast Asian 10 countries. They target to establish ASEAN community by the end of this year. I look forward to seeing regional economic integration, including free movement of goods, services, investment, skilled labor, and a freer flow of capital. Asia also faces challenges that could put at risk our goals of prosperity, stability, and dignity for all. These include competing territorial or maritime claims, political and communal tensions, and non-traditional security threats, such as transnational organized crimes and terrorism. I have consistently called on all parties to resolve their disputes in South China Sea in a peaceful and amicable manner through dialogue and in conformity with international law, including United Nations Charter. It's now more important than ever to avoid actions that would provoke or exacerbate tensions. Now, Southeast Asia is also experiencing a serious migration crisis in Andaman Sea and Bay of Bengal. As people in search of asylum are being left trapped at sea, saving lives must be top priority. I was in European Union just a few days ago, and I have gone to Mediterranean Sea with the Italian Prime Minister and European leaders to see for myself how these search and rescue operations are going on for all these migrants coming from North Africa. Now we have the same such situation in Southeast Asia. I remain very concerned at the plight of the Rohingya Muslims community in Myanmar. 3 years after the intercommunal violence in Western Rakhine State, some 130,000 still remain in camps, requiring urgent humanitarian assistance. The United Nations has, through various channels, strongly urged the government of Myanmar to ensure that human rights of Rohingya Muslims and other Muslim population are fully respected, and that longer-term issues of citizenship, identity permits, work permits, and birth registration are properly addressed. In Northeast Asia, I welcome the recent reciprocal visit to the celebration receptions by the leaders of Japan and Republic of Korea, marking the 50th anniversary of the normalization of Republic of Korea and Japan relations. I'm encouraged that both countries are exhibiting a spirit of cooperation. I regret that relations between South and North Korea still remains at the low ebb. improved relations would benefit both nations and the region as a whole. That is why I offered my visit to Kaesong Industrial Complex last month. While I regret the DPRK's sudden cancellation to my visit to Kaesong Industrial Complex, I remain committed and dedicated to doing whatever it takes to contribute to improving inter-Korean relations and promoting reconciliation and stability on the Korean Peninsula. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in an age of great challenge and great opportunity. This university stands at the forefront of our quest for solutions. Now, commemorating the 70th anniversary of the United Nations, I'm conscious of a certain criticism that the United Nations has not been doing enough. I humbly accept that kind of criticism. But had there not been United Nations, without peacekeepers, without United Nations continuing humanitarian assistance, and without United Nations advocacy for human rights, I'm afraid to tell you that this world might have been poorer, more dangerous, even bloodier without the United Nations. But having said that, I never take it complacent. There is no such complacency when it comes to United Nations engagement and commitment. United Nations, this largest, most legitimate universal organization, but we cannot do it alone. No country in this world, however powerful or resourceful, maybe, like the United States, you cannot do it alone. And United Nations cannot do it alone. We need a strong solidarity of all the people, government, and business communities, and civil societies, and each and every citizens like yours. We need to unite with the same purpose to make this world better for all the people, regardless where you are coming from, whether you are coming from south or north, whether regardless of ethnicities or sexual orientations, then every human being's human rights should be supported and promoted. In that regard, I highly welcome the decision this morning by the Supreme Court to recognize you already know what I was going to say. This is a great step forward for human rights in the United States, and I hope that this will send a strong message far and wide to the world, where still many people with a different sexual orientation, whose human rights are being abused and discriminated. Again, this is a very historic day, and I'm very proud to work as Secretary General of the United Nations, and I count on your continuing commitment and leadership and work as a global citizen. I thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Secretary General, for your wonderful remarks. Initially, we are going to have some panel discussion with Casey Stevens, but now he has other schedule in the city, so we have only like a few minutes for Q&A. So I think we'll take maybe a couple of questions from the floor, and then if he can come back a third time, right, in a couple of years. So,
yeah.
Okay, yeah, maybe. So can you just say who you are then?
And wait for the microphone. Hello, Secretary General. My name is Nick Bilogorsky.
I'm the president of a charity called Nova Ukraine. Last year, United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 2166 concerning the shootdown of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, which killed all 298 passengers and crew in Ukraine. As you know, Russia is fighting a war in Ukraine, and there is now more than a million refugees and internally displaced people in Ukraine. So my question to you is, what can and what will United Nations do to enforce the resolution to help the victims in Ukraine and stop the illegal Russian invasion and occupation of Ukraine? Thank you.
Since the outbreak of this Ugandan crisis, I have been continuously engaging with President Putin and Russian leadership, and also Ukrainian leadership, President Poroshenko. And even last month, I was in Moscow and Ukraine, and I have been speaking over the phones, and I met President Putin. That was most recent, but I have been meeting and speaking with him all the times. I have been urging that all the charter provisions of the United Nations must be respected, and all these crises should be resolved peacefully through dialogue. I welcomed this Minsk agreement, which was adopted in February 12, which may not be perfect, but still it can give a good guidelines so that the parties concerned can resolve this issue through dialogue. There are some package of measures. I have been urging both parties to respect and fully implement this Minsk Accord. That is my consistent position. Unfortunately, because of the division of the Security Council, they have not been able to make some good agreement which can give some binding resolution. While this situation is going on, and while this Minsk Accord is now largely being held, I'm very much concerned that these daily violations are taking place. Since February, more than 400 people have been killed. And there have been a lot of people internally displaced. United Nations has been deploying human rights monitoring team and regularly reporting to the United Nations Security Council. And we have been mobilizing the humanitarian assistance who really need humanitarian assistance on a daily basis. We will try to expand this kind of a capacity of delivering humanitarian assistance. But it's important that parties concerned, they have faithfully implement this Minsk Accord. Thank you.
Yeah, one final question.
Thank you. I'm Sam Chen. I used to be the visiting scholar of the APAC. Today is my little son Dan's birthday. He asked me, "Yeah, what is the UN? How can I tell him in a simple word for 8 years old the kid? What's the UN?"
UN welcomes all, particularly young people who would work for world peace and the human rights and the sustainable development. Our doors are wide open. We do not discriminate. When it comes to the opportunities, I can clearly proudly say that United Nations is the most impartial organization. Some people may think that United Nations is neutral, but United Nations cannot be neutral. When we see abhorrent violations of UN Charter, we have to criticize. But we are impartial. Wherever you are coming from, whatever you are doing, we open our doors. And we need to work with the young people. After all, I will soon hand over my torch as a Secretary General. But I sincerely hope that the more capable and more visionary and young generations will take charge of this world. Often we say that you are the leaders of the tomorrow, future, but the many young people have taken their leadership role in already today and today. For example, Arab Spring has started from young people, not from leaders. Therefore, I'm asking young leaders and women, take more role. Therefore, gender empowerment and how to harness the power and energy of young people, that's one of my top priorities. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Secretary General. I wish we could continue our conversation, but I was informed that he has to leave for other events in the city. And once again, thank you very much for coming to our university. And then I hope that you can make third trip in a couple of years. Thank you.